Thank you. And now, Pastor Comparé.
Tonight I want to talk to you about something a little bit different. I've called it the continuing priesthood, because we get into something where a good many of the churches have gotten themselves pretty well mixed up. The first mention in the Bible of a priest of the Most High God is the mention of Melchizedek in Genesis 14, verse 18. Now, he is clearly proven there, of course, not to be a pagan priest, but a priest of the Most High God. And while it does not say in so many words that this was Jesus Christ himself, yet the clear inference is that that is who it was. You can pretty well figure it out from study of the circumstances. Now, until you get down to, at least the time when the Israelites were in Egypt, all mention, other than Melchizedek, all mention of priests would be of the various pagan priests of the region. But you remember that when they went to Egypt, that Joseph married the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of the city of On, later called Heliopolis. Now, the Bible uses for him the word which is restricted to a priest of the true God, Cohen. There's a variant form of it, Cohen. Cohen is the most commonly used. Now, that is no doubt a correct use. You remember that long before this time, a people known as the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, a Semitic people, moved out of Palestine into Egypt. And they conquered and ruled Egypt for a period of time. We can't tell exactly how long. You see, the Egyptian historical records were kept by the priests, that is to say, the pagan priests. And anything that they didn't want known too much, they suppressed in the same way that our newspapers today suppress the truth. Now, one thing they did record is that the first thing these Hyksos did when they came in was to close every pagan temple in Egypt, drive the priests out and make them go to work if they wanted a living, and to try to introduce the worship of the one true God. Now, this city of On is one of the things built by the Hyksos while they were there. And no doubt, although this, you see, was before the Exodus, well, in fact, it started some centuries before the Exodus, it was undoubtedly a church of the true God established there. Because the pagan priests messed up the historical records so much, there are some of the records that indicate that the Hyksos ruled in Egypt about 2.5 centuries. Others would indicate it was as long as 5 centuries. So we can't be altogether sure, but we do know that during that time, their utmost to stamp out paganism. Now, at the time of the Exodus, you remember the Bible says there came a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And then is when the persecution began. Joseph, of course, was raised to high position under the Pharaoh because the Pharaoh of Joseph's time was one of his own kinsmen, one of these Hyksos shepherd kings. And things went thrivingly under him. But their reign was overthrown, a century or so after Joseph's time, 2 centuries probably, and then began the persecution of the Israelites. The stay in Egypt was, as I remember it, around 230 years or something like that. Now, the Bible, having been so strict all the way down, from Adam on down, to make sure that there was no marriage outside of the true race line, we can be quite sure that Joseph did not marry a mere Egyptian. He married the daughter of a priest of this Hyksos group, and therefore one of his own race. And that priest is given the name of a Kohen, a priest. Then, of course, at Mount Sinai, after the Israelites had left Egypt, you found the establishment of a priesthood. Now, up until that time, the patriarch of each family, the oldest man of the family, was the family priest. He taught them what they should know, and as priest, he offered their sacrifices. But now, for the entire nation, a priesthood was set up at Mount Sinai. That's in the 28th chapter of Exodus and thereafter. And Moses' brother, Aaron, was chosen as the first high priest. Up until that time, the oldest son was the one chosen for all the most important things. And, naturally enough, that was a time when your freedom and that of your family depended on your good right arm and your sharp sword. And when the father died, if the family were lucky enough, his oldest son was man enough to take over and keep things going. But instead of choosing the oldest son of each family now to continue as a priest, God set that aside and said that he was taking only the tribe of Levi. Here you find an interesting thing, by the way. Our ancestor Jacob was by no means an admirable character. God chose him, yes, to be one of the ancestors of our race because he was purebred, but not because of his good qualities of character, because they were so lamentably lacking. When they came into Palestine, and when they came to the little town of Shechem and stopped there for a day or two, the son of the king of Shechem raped Jacob's daughter, Dinah. Well, Jacob didn't want any fuss made over that. You know, business is business. You've got to get along with these people or they'll boycott us and so forth. And he wasn't going to do anything about it. And two of his sons, Levi and Simeon, said he's not going to treat our sister like a harlot. Now, it took a bit of strategy to do it. But they did kill all the men of the village of Shechem, which really raised the moral tone of the community a great deal. Well, old Jacob raved and ranted about that. Why, he said, you've given me a bad reputation here now. People won't like me on account of this. And even to his deathbed, in the 49th chapter of Genesis, when Jacob was dying in Israel, and he called his sons before him to give each one his blessing and his prophecy, he still hadn't forgotten that Simeon and Levi had interfered with business. And he spoke very disparagingly of them. Maybe it would be well to just read the exact wording of it. You get an insight into the man. Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. That is, the sword with which they had slain the men of Shechem. O my soul, come not thou into their secret. Unto their assembly, mine honor, be not thou united. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, when you see how God regards this thing, when it came to choosing of all the people of Israel those to be his priests, God chose the tribe of Levi. In other words, Levi put the family honor above business profit, as Jacob did not. So, the tribe of Levi, while they had their human failings too, Nevertheless, they were chosen for a bit of higher character than their father had shown. Now, you remember he said, I will divide them in Jacob and I will scatter them in Israel. Now, that's an odd prophecy, but it was actually carried out. When the whole nation got to the promised land of Palestine, each of the tribes was allotted its own separate tribal area, so that in that particular area, no one but the tribe of Dan or whatever it happened to be were living there, so that the tribe could maintain its identity. But the tribe of Levi was not given any separate tribal area. It was intended by God that they should be scattered throughout the entire territory of Israel for a purpose that we'll discuss shortly. Now, the tribe of Simeon were given the southernmost part of all, south even of the tribe of Judah. You remember that the city of Jerusalem lay right on the borderline, or just barely north of the borderline, into the tribal territory of Benjamin. Just south of that was Judah. And then the very southernmost part was Simeon. Now, when the split-up came on the death of Solomon, the tribe of Simeon joined the nine northerly tribes in revolt. Now, they couldn't stay down there, cut off from the only friends they had. They would have been brutally massacred and reduced to slavery, no doubt, by the ambitious tribe of Judah. So what they had to do was to abandon their country and march on up north into the territory of the northern tribes, where they could not have a separate place to themselves, and they had to scatter, settling a man here and a man there as best they could. So it was true that they were scattered in Israel. But now as to why Levi was scattered there. The Levites had quite a variety of duties. Now, both Moses and Aaron, being brothers, they were descendants of Levi. And the one family of Aaron and his sons, and of course widening out in future generations, his descendants, they were chosen for a specific part of the priesthood. And that was the ceremonial offerings, first in the tabernacle during the 40 years' wandering, and finally in the temple. The only ones who actually offered the sacrifices on the altar were descendants of Aaron. And the only one who could ever go into the innermost portion of the tabernacle or temple, the Holy of Holies, was the high priest. Aaron and then his oldest son and so on down each generation, the oldest son became the high priest. But all of the other priestly duties were performed by Levites. Now, at the temple itself, the Levites, for example, were in charge of the temple treasury, and the high priest got his salary handed to him out of the temple treasury by Levites who were not of the family of Aaron, but were of the tribe of Levi. Then they had a wide variety of duties. In Numbers 3, verse 11, God explained he had taken the Levites. And I have taken the Levites from the midst of the sons of Israel. Instead of every firstborn opening a womb among the sons of Israel, and the Levites are mine. Well, good reason for it showed up. You remember that all the people of Israel, while they were still in Egypt, had seen miracle after miracle performed by Moses under God's command and direction. Then, on the Exodus, they had seen the pillar of cloud by day leading them, guiding them on, and then going behind them to stand as a rear guard, a pillar of fire by night, between them and their enemies. They had seen the Red Sea divided, so they crossed dry shod, and then the waters come together and drown the pursuing Egyptian army. They had gone out into a waterless desert where there was neither food nor water for themselves or their flocks and herds, and they had seen the manna given them as food, and they had seen water great quantities of water brought forth out of the rock. Now, you'd think by that time they would begin to understand that this was something truly supernatural, that this indicated that the one leading them and protecting them was the true God. They were as stupid in their generation as most of our people are in our generation. Moses went up to Mount Sinai for his long conference with God, where he was to receive detailed instructions. And after he'd been up there some 2 or 3 weeks, the people went to Aaron and they said, "As for this man Moses, we don't know what's become of him. He's gone up on that mountain, he said, to talk to some sort of God or other. We don't know whether he's coming back. Now you make us some idols as our gods to lead us." Well, Aaron was one of these middle-of-the-roaders, you know, a man who doesn't like anything controversial. Sometimes we wonder exactly what God saw in him to choose him, but anyway, God was very patient. So Aaron said to the people, "Well, bring me all your gold jewelry so I'll have some metal to make these gods out of, and I'll make some gods for you." And he cast a golden calf. And God said to Moses up in the mountain, God said, "Your people down there have corrupted themselves already. You better get down there and see to this." So when Moses came down, here were the people hooping it up and worshiping the golden calf. And when the indignant Moses confronted Aaron with this, Aaron said, "Well, they said they wanted gods, and I put this gold in the fire, and why, out came this calf." Nothing said, of course, about who made the mold in which the calf was cast. Well, God had given instructions to Moses. All the ringleaders, at least, in this worship of the idol were to be killed. And you notice that the tribe of Levi had not become apostates. When Moses said, "Who's on my side? Who'll take your sword and go through the camp and kill these people?" the whole tribe of Levi responded. So there was in Levi as a tribe, even if not in one of their members, Aaron, there was the right spirit. So they were all loyal to God at that time. That's Exodus 32, verses 26 to 28. That they were given no separate tribal territory, you find set out in Deuteronomy 10, verses 8 and 9, and chapter 18, verses 1 and 2. As to the extent of their duties that they performed at the temple, all the priestly duties, excepting only offering sacrifices on the altar, see Numbers 4, verses 3, 23, and 30, 1 Chronicles 23, verses 2 and 3, and chapter 9, verses 14 to 34. Now, they served in these priestly duties from the age of 30 to 50. Until 30, they weren't sufficiently instructed. That wasn't one of these quickie, go in the university the front door and out the back door systems like we have now. You remember the Druid universities in Britain had a 20-year course of study. And here, oh, undoubtedly, before they reached the age of 20, their instruction had begun, but they were not allowed to practice as priests until the age of 30. And you notice that Jesus Christ followed that. He waited until the age of 30 before he began his ministry. Well, besides duties around the temple, and by the way, the system was set up so that every Levite, no matter how far distant his home was, twice a year went to the temple at Jerusalem for a period of 2 weeks. He was part of the temple operative staff, and of course it kept him brushed up. It was a refresher course for him too. But aside from that, the Levites remained in their own homes. But definitely they were ranked as priests, although below the high priest. See Ezekiel 43, verse 19, and Jeremiah 33, verses 17 to 18. but now they made up the entire governmental civil service. Someone had to keep order. Someone had to see that there were suitable policemen appointed, that courts were held. Someone had to see to it that whatever the village needed, if they needed an improvement of their water supply, for example, that workmen were drafted to do it. And those who could not do the work themselves contributed in money toward the expense and all that. So, as officers running the entire nation of Israel, you had the Levites. See, 1 Chronicles 23, verse 4, and 26, verses 20 and 26. They were judges. Now, in those days, even though Palestine was small, a country about 125 miles long, that's a long way to travel on foot. And for trials, especially in minor matters, you couldn't expect them to go to Jerusalem for it. So there had to be judges to hear all cases, both civil lawsuits and criminal trials, in every village. So the Levites were judges. See 1 Chronicles 23, verse 4, 26, verses 20 and 26, and 2 Chronicles 34, verses 12 and 13. Then, perhaps their most important job, they were the teachers. Without this, the end of one generation would have seen the end of their religion. So, the teachers were always Levites. Ezekiel 44, verse 23. 2 Chronicles 17, verses 8 and 9, and chapter 35, verse 3. Nehemiah, chapter 8, verse 9, and Malachi 2, verse 7. Some of them were even prophets. Now, the ordinary teacher, of course, was teaching from the works of Moses and, later on, the books of some of the other prophets. In other words, he was not purporting to be acting under direct divine inspiration, but teaching them what had been given through the prophets as a matter of divine inspiration. But a few of the Levites also were among those who had divine inspiration as prophets. See 2 Chronicles 20, verses 14 to 17. Now, as you know today, throughout the United States, in every county of every state, there is one town which is the county seat. It has the courthouse, and the various county officers have their headquarters there. And so there had to be places where you had not just a single Levite family living, but places where there was a thorough governmental organization. So the Levites were allotted certain cities. For example, 8 in the territory of Judah, 3 in Benjamin, and so on. And it added up to 75 cities altogether. That's an average of 6 1/4 cities per tribe. See 1 Chronicles 6, verses 61 to 81. But they didn't all congregate in these cities. There were supposed to be Levites in every village so that whenever any problem came up, you had a Levite officer to order whatever was necessary done. You had a Levite judge to hear all cases. You had a Levite teacher. See 1 Chronicles 9, verse 2. All the other tribes were subject to military service. The Levites were not. In the registration for service, the Levites were not registered. See Numbers 1, verse 47, and 2, verse 33. That doesn't mean that no Levites went out with the army to war, but they went as priests, and, well, like your modern chaplain, and not as warriors. They had another thing that set them apart from the other tribes, and that was in the matter of redemption. I've explained that to you before. A farm was the family's means of making a living. If they lost the farm, well, they were out of luck. They could stay there as semi-slaves, working for somebody else. They could drift into the city and become a city rabble, such as brought about the downfall of Rome. And because God knew exactly what was going to happen when you did accumulate a great city rabble, he didn't allow it to happen in Israel. When Italy was a nation of independent farmers, and the most independent people on earth are farmers, Rome rose to greatness, to empire over all the world they knew. But that didn't last. Because you had Jewish moneylenders among them, farmers always are up against the occasional bad year. Drought, poor crops for one reason or another, and they had to borrow money. And pretty soon, the money lenders foreclosed on the farm. In a few cases, perhaps they bought it from farmers foolish enough to sell. And these people had no place to go but to drift into Rome and be supported on the dole. Give us bread and circuses. Today, give us relief and television. And that is the thing that brought about the downfall of Rome. These people had nothing to fight for. This wasn't their empire anymore. They were just being supported on public charity. Rome had to rely upon foreign mercenaries to raise an army, even for her own defense. And pretty soon these mercenaries decided that, well, maybe this rich city here might just as well be plundered by them as by anybody else. And there you had the downfall of a mighty empire. Well, God was determined that was not going to happen to his people. As to a farm, if you sold it or lost it by foreclosure, you had the right to redeem it at any time by paying back the unused portion of what you had received. If you were unable to buy it back, then God redeemed it for you in the Jubilee year. It came back to you. So that was every 50th year. It came back to you with no payment at all. In other words, you couldn't sell anything more than the use of your farm for the years remaining until the next Jubilee year. Neither could you mortgage anymore. Now, as to a home in a walled city, that was a different thing. The people who lived in those cities were mostly the skilled artisans. If a man was a blacksmith or a goldsmith or a saddle maker or whatnot, it didn't particularly matter which house he lived in and worked in. He could do that just as well on one side of town as another. So as for city property, you had the right to redeem within 1 year. And if you did not exercise the right within a year, you could not redeem afterward. But a Levite never lost the right to redeem his city home. He was given special treatment above the rest of the people. Remember, it was important not just to him, it was important to God that he stay there in that village that he was assigned to, because he had a tremendous job on his hands trying to keep a stupid and rebellious people going along the right course. See Leviticus 25, verses 32 and 33. Now, in the book of Hebrews, you read some things that are rather easily misconstrued, and the churches have said, oh, all the old priesthood is done away with. But now that's not the way the Bible tells it. You remember that David and his descendants were promised that they would never lack a man to sit upon the throne over the house of Israel. And the very next verse promises equal permanence to the Levitical priesthood. Here it is, Jeremiah 33, verses 17 to 18. For thus saith Yahweh, David shall never lack a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel, neither shall the priests of the Levites lack a man before me to offer burnt offerings and to kindle meal offerings and to do sacrifice continually. So they are promised a priesthood as permanent as the kingship. When Moses was at the end of his days, God had told him, a couple of days from now, why, you're going to die. He called the tribes before him, assembled them for a final talking to, and to give his blessing to the different tribes. And here's what he said to the tribe of Levi. Now remember, the high priesthood, the house of Aaron, was part of the tribe of Levi. This is Deuteronomy 33, verses 8 to 11. And I'm reading it as it reads in the Hebrew. And of Levi, he said, thy Thummim and thy Urim are for thy pious one, whom thou hast tried at Massah, who did strive with him at the waters of Meribah, who was saying of his father and his mother, I have not seen them, and his brethren he has not discerned, and his sons he has not known. Now that sounds odd, but you find substantially the same thing in the New Testament. You remember the incident where Jesus Christ was in the house talking to some people, and someone came in and said, your mother and your brothers are waiting outside and they want to see you. He said, who is my mother or my brother? Those who do the will of my Father. In other words, mere blood relationship alone is not enough to make it. To qualify, you must also be one of those who do the will of your Father, God. Now, that is what he was talking about here as to Levi, who was saying of his father and mother, I have not seen them. His brethren he has not discerned. His sons he has not known. Now, while they were still out on the march in the Exodus, you remember the two oldest sons of Aaron decided they were going to take the priesthood on themselves ahead of time. So they took censers and put fire in it and sprinkled incense on it and started into the tabernacle to burn incense. And God killed them both right then and there. And Moses warned Aaron. He said, now you're not to show grief over this. This is not something that you can go around, boo-hoo, isn't it too bad that a mean old God killed my sons for just doing this and so on. This is to impress upon you how important the priesthood is. And it is not to be taken lightly and in a way that shows no respect to God. So, apparently there was some basis for this. Moses goes on, for they have observed thy saying, and thy covenant they keep. They teach thy judgments to Jacob and thy law to Israel. They put perfume in thy nostrils, that is burning the incense before the altar, and whole burnt offerings on thine altar. Bless, O Yahweh, his strength, and accept the work of his hands. Smite the loins of those that rise up against him and those that hate him, that they rise not again. So you had something very important here in the entire Levitical priesthood, and not exclusively in the Aaronic priesthood. As a matter of fact, the Aaronic priesthood became corrupted, you might say, about as badly as the house of David. Probably history has no record of as many scoundrels who escaped a well-merited hanging as the descendants of David who were kings over the kingdom of Judah. Now, God said, as to any one of these who disobeys me, I'm going to punish him. I will not destroy the kingdom. I will see to it that there is a descendant of David on the throne, but I will hold each one of them individually responsible to me for his conduct. Now you find the same thing applying here in the priesthood. The Aaronic priesthood became so corrupted. If you will read in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, now, Jeremiah was in Jerusalem from before the first deportation to Babylon until after the second deportation. Ezekiel was taken to Babylon in the deportation. And Ezekiel says, God took me in a vision in the spirit back to the temple in Jerusalem. And here, in the very temple itself, pagan idols had been set up and were being worshipped. And this by Aaronic priests. So actually, the Levitical priesthood was much more of a success than the Aaronic priesthood. We might note, by the way, something about the priest's costume. You know, of course, that the official uniform of the high priest was very beautifully embroidered and ornamented. But in general, the garments to be worn by any priest serving at the temple. First, there was what is called the coat, Exodus 28, verse 39, of fine linen and embroidered. Now, that was the typical Oriental long garment, a sort of robe worn next to the body. Nothing is said about any color on it, so it was presumably the white of the natural linen. Then they wore breeches of linen, Exodus 28, verses 42 and 43. And again, since no color is stated, it was presumably the natural white linen. Now, over this coat, then they wore what is called the robe of the ephod. See Exodus 28, verses 31 to 35. This was a long, seamless garment of linen. You've seen what the Mexicans call a poncho. It's a square of cloth with a hole in the middle for the head. You put it over your head, and it serves somewhat for warmth, and if it's waterproofed, why, it makes a very good raincoat. Now, a little on that order, but not just a mere square, was this robe of the ephod. It was all blue. Here's the first time you come to colored cloth in a priest's garments. All blue and embroidered with purple and scarlet. And along the bottom hem had small golden bells attached to it. This was worn, as I say, put over the head. And then there was an embroidered girdle or belt to hold it. And, of course, that left openings at the sides for the arms. Then, what is called the ephod, Exodus 28, verses 6 to 28, of linen, and since no color is mentioned, again, presumably white, embroidered with gold, blue, purple, and scarlet. Now, this was a short jacket made in two pieces, front and back, and then fastened together by shoulder pieces. One on each shoulder, they wore two onyx stones, each of which was engraved with the names of six of the tribes. Then over that ephod, they wore the breastplate. See Exodus 28, verses 15 to 30. Now this was a square pouch of linen to contain the Urim and Thummim. We'll say a little more about that later. This was embroidered with blue, purple, and scarlet. And then, in the center of it, was fastened a golden plate set with four rows of three stones each, each stone engraved with the name of one of the 12 tribes of Israel. The golden plate was fastened to the linen breastplate by blue laces, and the entire linen breastplate was attached to the ephod by golden chains and blue laces. The Urim and Thummim, the words mean lights and perfections. Their names alone are given. No description appears anywhere in the Bible. Whatever they were carried in this linen pouch of the breastplate, and they were consulted at times to get an answer to a question in a yes or no form. Should we go march out to meet that army coming against them? Yes or no? And they would get their answer from God, yes, go out and fight them in the field, or no, stay in the city behind your walls, as the case might be. We may guess that possibly there was some such thing as shaking this pouch, the ephod, until one or the other first flopped out of it, and one represented a yes answer and the other a no.